Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see something.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Emily Lopez, MD, MPH, is a general medicine and primary care research fellow at Cambridge Health Alliance and Harvard Medical School. This fall, she'll be on the faculty at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Lopez is lead author of an article published August 5, 2024 in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine entitled Health, Access to Care, and Financial Barriers to Care Among People Incarcerated in U.S. Prisons. Dr. Lopez, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, let's start from the top. What led you to look at healthcare and healthcare access for people who are incarcerated?
That's a great question. So I did my residency training in internal medicine at a safety net hospital, which meant that we took care of a lot of people who were incarcerated or had criminal justice involvement previously. And there was one patient that really stood out to me who was currently incarcerated at the time I took care of him in the hospital. And he had a heart condition that required him to have an internally placed defibrillator. And he was in the hospital because his defibrillator had gone off several times at prison. And despite his defibrillator going off, he still was struggling to access care. It took his defibrillator going off multiple times before he was finally ever able to make it to the hospital. And I just found this striking because, you know, in the community, if somebody's defibrillator goes off, they're instructed to immediately go to the emergency room. But somebody in prison doesn't have that kind of autonomy and power to just go to the emergency room. And so this really opened my eyes to the fact that there are access to care issues for people who are in prison. And so I started, you know, looking into this more. And what I found was pretty shocking. I found that people in prison have poor access to care, despite having a large burden of both chronic physical and mental health conditions. And there are several reasons for this that people have identified, including medical staffing shortages, in part due to underfunding, limited and fragmented oversight and regulation. And there's really just a lack of commonly accepted standards of care that are enforced in prisons. You know, one of the things that I learned that was probably the most shocking was that people in prison are frequently charged co-pays for medical care, even though prison jobs pay as little as 4 cents an hour. And that's even if their jobs are paid for at all. And so there have been some reports about this, some smaller studies, but there really wasn't anything looking at this from a national perspective. And so I became really interested in understanding more about co-pays in prison and how they impact access to care for people.
What did you find?
What we found, our results are pretty troubling, but honestly also not that surprising. So we looked at nationally representative federal data that provides the best and most recent information on self-reported health of people in both state and federal prisons in the U.S. We also used publicly available information about prison medical co-pays and prison minimum wages, which we used to help do our analysis about access to care related to co-pays. We really have three main findings from our study. The first being that the prevalence of chronic health conditions and mental health conditions are high and appear to be increasing. So one example of that is that we found that in our population, more than 60% of people had one or more chronic physical conditions. And this is despite an average age of being only 39 years old. And then another example is that high blood pressure has increased from 21% to 29% from 2004 to 2016. So secondly, we found that access to healthcare was poor. One example of that is that 14% of people with a chronic health condition had not seen a provider, a healthcare provider, since their admission to prison. And our final finding was that people in states with medical co-pays in prison were significantly less likely to have seen a clinician since the start of their incarceration. So the way that we looked at this was co-pays as a function of minimum wage. And so we basically categorized people into three different groups, one being people in states where there's no co-pay, people in states where the co-pay is less than or equal to 1 week's prison wage, or the third group, people in states that have co-pays that are greater than 1 week's prison wage. And even just categorizing people by those groups was kind of shocking to think that, you know, people could be in a prison where their copay is greater than an entire week's worth of wage. And what we discovered was that 90% of incarcerated people with one or more chronic health conditions resided in a state with policies requiring copays for at least some medical visits. And 62.4% of them, the medical copay was greater than an entire week's wage, which was just pretty shocking. But the results got even worse. We also found that people with one or more chronic health conditions, for those people, the likelihood of never having seen a doctor since incarceration was more than double for those living in a state with a copay greater than 1 week's wage compared to people in states with no copays.
Now, okay, so back up for context. Now, what's the state of health, the chronic conditions? What kind of conditions are folks reporting?
All sorts of things that we would also see in the community. So things like high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, asthma, and then there's the infectious diseases as well, such as HIV, hepatitis C, tuberculosis. And then, you know, aside from the physical conditions, there's a lot of mental health conditions as well, depression, anxiety, and then things like psychotic disorders and bipolar disorder.
And then you've also, now you're also looking, it's a mixed population. There are also a number of pregnant people in your sample.
Yeah, that's correct. A smaller number, because in general, less women are incarcerated than men. But yeah, there were people who were pregnant upon incarceration in our study. And for them, we looked at whether or not they had had any obstetrical care prior to delivery.
So what kind of, I mean, what'd you find?
Yeah, what we found was that 9% of people who are pregnant upon admission to prison did not receive any sort of obstetrical exam prior to their delivery of their baby. And we also found that half of them had not received any sort of education about pregnancy and childbirth once they entered prison before giving birth.
What kind of access to health care do people who are incarcerated typically have? I mean, did you find, I mean, are there infirmaries anymore? Does a doctor visit? What kind of access do people could people have if they can afford it?
Yeah, so well, one thing that makes the answer to that question a little bit tricky is that as you probably know, and many of your listeners probably know, you know, each state Department of Corrections runs the state prisons, and then the federal Department of Corrections runs the federal prisons. And so what that means is that there are 50 different Department of Correction or 51 different Department of Corrections that are running things differently. So healthcare looks different for each state and for the federal Department of Corrections, which makes understanding these issues really challenging because there's so much fragmentation, and there's not really any unified body that's evaluating if people are getting the standard of care, setting the standard of care, and regulating any of this. And so, broadly speaking, what people in prison do is if they need to request a doctor's visit, they place a sick call slip. And that sometimes doesn't get viewed for days. Sometimes it gets viewed immediately. It really just depends. And then somebody determines if, you know, what the next appropriate action will be. Sometimes they might see a nurse. Sometimes they might go directly to a physician. It really varies. Some prisons do offer health exams upon admission, and those can act as screens for chronic conditions or mental health conditions. And if a provider in a system knows that a certain person has a condition, they can initiate a visit. So the provider can actually initiate a visit. But that takes a lot of it means that a provider would have to know about these conditions. And when we've talked to healthcare providers, you know, on the ground that are working in prisons, what we learned was that, you know, many people don't get screened upon admission. And so a lot of people that have chronic conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, or mental health conditions, these don't get detected when they come to prison. And so the burden is on them to request a visit. And then requesting a visit then results in a copay for a lot of people, which can be devastating to somebody who's making, you know, pennies per hour.
This is my conversation with Dr. Emily Lopez, a general medicine and primary care research fellow at Cambridge Health Alliance and Harvard Medical School, who's lead author of an article entitled Health, Access to Care, and Financial Barriers to Care Among People Incarcerated in U.S. Prisons, which was published recently in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear the rest of my interview with Dr. Emily Lopez. Talk with me a little more about the copays that people who are incarcerated have to pay. I mean, copays on prison wages. I sometimes despair of humanity. Apologies. My apologies. Anyway, talk to me if you could a bit about these copays and actually bring it back again to the birth behind bars and the impact on pregnant people. What kind of impact are these copays having? And did you tease out general population and then, as I say, and the population of pregnant people?
Yeah, so copays are, you know, most people are familiar with copays because they're a strategy utilized in the community as well. And copays are generally implemented to help control healthcare costs. What we know about copays in the community is that they worsen access to care and also worsen some health outcomes. So it's not hard to believe that this is also happening in prison. Copays in prison started in the 1990s, as I mentioned, as a mechanism to control healthcare costs. In 2000, it was actually mandated by Congress to implement copays in federal prisons. At the time of our study, 42 states plus the Federal Department of Corrections had copays. Since then, three states, Virginia, California, and Illinois, have eliminated copays. And Texas has actually modified their copay. So there has been some progress since this study was done. But we've thought it was important to look at copays as a function of minimum wage, because when you hear what the average copays are, it can sound to somebody who's not in prison like this is not that much. So copays on average are $2 to $8, though at the time of our study, Texas charged a $100 one-time fee if you utilized any healthcare that was charged annually. And so those numbers sound okay, except that the average minimum wage at the time of our study was anywhere between 4 to 40 cents per hour. And let me just remind you that some prison jobs are not compensated for. So this is a minimum wage if you are in fact paid and if in fact you are able to work. And so that equates to anywhere from $69 to over $1,000 copay in the community if you were making minimum wage in the community. And so, you know, one fact that's really interesting about copays is that in 1976, there was a Supreme Court ruling that found that deliberate indifference to a prisoner's serious illness would violate the Constitution's Eighth Amendment protection against cruel and unusual punishment. And what this did was it essentially made people in prison the only group in the U.S. with a constitutional right to health care. So if copays are truly impeding care or needed care, as we think that they are, then they're a violation of the constitutional rights of people who are incarcerated. In an attempt to prevent copays from impeding appropriate health care use, some states have implemented copay waivers for specific types of visits. So what this means is that if you meet certain criteria, then you're waived from having to pay the copay. And one of the important types of waivers that are out there is waivers for chronic health conditions. However, you might be thinking, oh, well, that's great. Then, you know, what do these results really mean then if you're looking at people with chronic health conditions and how copays impact their access to care? What we found is that 85% of these waivers have critical restrictions, such as only applying if the visit was initiated by a clinician. So as we were talking about earlier, many people don't get screened for conditions on admission to prison. And so the prison health system has no way of knowing who has, you know, what conditions. So many people fall through the cracks. And then say, for example, somebody, you know, with high blood pressure knows that they have high blood pressure, but the clinicians don't know that they have high blood pressure because they were never screened for this, then they have to initiate care. And then thus they have to pay the copay, even if there is a waiver within that state. Another example might be, you know, somebody with, diabetes having symptoms of high or low blood sugar. They're experiencing these symptoms. And so they initiate a visit. Because they initiated it, even though it's related to their chronic condition, the copay would fall on them because they initiated the visit. And so while these waivers are out there, we don't really know how well they're functioning to help appropriate care be received, and how well they're doing at preventing preventing people from getting the care that they need. To answer your question about how this relates to women's care, specifically pregnancy obstetrics care, there are some states that have waivers for any sort of pregnancy care, but it's actually only 35% of the Department of Corrections have pregnancy waivers. That equates to 13 states and the federal Department of Corrections. So for all the other states, either there's no mention of pregnancy care being waived, or pregnancy care also requires a copay.
They said the average age was in the 30s.
Yeah, the average age for our study was only 39. So for, 60% of that population to have a chronic health condition is that's a large proportion.
And some of the other work we've been doing, looking at things like, excessively long sentences, the life without paroles, and the rest of it, the problem of an aging population within prisons, and the number of people. I suppose this is. I mean, these things are only going to get worse.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. I mean, that's certainly an important point to make for this population. It is an aging population, and in the terms of the average age is going up because of long sentences, like you mentioned, and mandatory minimums, et cetera. But there's also a process called accelerated physiological aging that's going on as well. And what this means is that the physiology or the physical functioning of somebody in prison at a certain age is different from somebody outside of prison because of the added stress of being in prison, the lack of nutritious food, the poor air quality, the inadequate access to exercise, the stress of solitary confinement, and other means, other tools that are used in prison. And so what we find is that people in prison often have onset of disease at an earlier age, such as things that we typically associate with older people, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, et cetera. People are having those at younger ages because of this physiologic accelerated aging.
And I want to ask you about some of the implications of your research. And I usually ask about policy. This is a standard question. But before we get to that, I mean, what are the implications of these policies for the people incarcerated on their access to care, on the quality to care, and people get out eventually. I mean, it's eventually
It's a
most
huge
people end up
problem.
leaving prison, and they're going to be back
Yeah.
out into the community. I mean, what are the, so again, I want to ask you about the implications of your research, but first for these people.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there are many implications to think about. On the one hand, what we see when people can't access, preventative care and care at the point that they need it is that their condition's worse, they worsen, they experience more complications. And this not only has poor health outcomes for that person, but it also incurs higher costing care. So it's not good for the system either. And so you made a great point that, majority of people that are incarcerated will eventually return to the community. And so it's shifting the responsibility of caring for these people to the community. People are leaving prison sicker and older than when they entered prison. And the burden of that is falling on the community healthcare systems, because they're the ones that are receiving patients coming out of prison, and trying to help put them back into better states of health after they've, gone without their medication or gone without any sort of, preventative care or health maintenance care.
And they're released out into the public where their families are probably tapped out because their families and loved ones have been helping to pay for their care in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just thinking, I just wanted to bring that up as well. Many people in prison, first of all, copays force them to choose between, things like taking care of their health or things that they might need for survival, like for a menstruating woman, tampons, for example, they have to pay for in the commissary at some prisons. And so there, or telephone calls to loved ones are also things that sometimes have to be paid for out of their own account. And so they have a very small amount of money that they're having to divvy up in multiple ways. And so they're forced to make really difficult and challenging decisions. And what this means is that for a lot of people, Their family or loved ones are trying to help supplement their accounts. But many people, as you know, in prison come from impoverished communities. And so it's making people who are already, you know, suffering financially suffer even more. So it doesn't just impact the person in prison, it impacts families and communities outside of prison as well. And while no care can be denied for somebody who cannot afford to pay, and every state's and the federal Department of Corrections copay policies do explicitly state that, they can be charged a debt to their account for the copay. And so only five Department of Corrections actually waive the copay if you're indigent, if you meet indigent status or can't pay. All the other ones either didn't mention what would happen or actually charge a debt to your account that's paid off anytime money comes into your account. And then in some states, if you leave prison and you have a debt to pay, this gets sent to collections. So you have medical debt. And even beyond that, in some states, you can't obtain a driver's license or register to vote if you have debt to the carceral system. And so these copays are not, you know, something to just think, oh, well, you know, it's standard to pay for part of your health care. The cost sharing is, you know, pretty much we all have to do it. It has such a bigger impact on people who are incarcerated.
With all this and the barriers that we throw up and the abusive treatment and the gotchas and the debts and we still blame people who are leaving prisons, people who are getting out for reasons why they may recidivate or why they may violate or why they may go back.
Yeah, I mean, there's some data out there about, you know, people that have the recidivism rate for people that have court fees to pay once, like debts to the carceral system, the carceral system for court fees and other administrative fees when they leave. And there's some data that shows that recidivism is higher for those people. So I imagine it's similar for people that have debt from, you know, medical visits. It's not helping people be set up for success when they leave prison.
So what are the policy implications of this research you've done?
So, you know, first and foremost, I think our research argues that we should eliminate copays. I think it's clear that copays are impeding needed access to care for people and may even be infringing upon constitutional rights. So I think first and foremost, we want to, you know, call on all states and the Federal Department of Corrections to eliminate copays. And I want to point out that a couple of states, at least Massachusetts being one of them, do have active bills to eliminate copays. And so, you know, COVID enlightened a lot of things about prison healthcare for many people who didn't know much about this topic. And during COVID, a lot of copays were put on pause. And so it was an opportunity for some states to reevaluate, you know, should we be doing this? And so, as I mentioned earlier, some states have eliminated copays since the study that we did. And there are some bills out there to eliminate copays. So hopefully those continue to happen and more people will advocate for their states and the Federal Department of Corrections to eliminate copays. But there are some other policy implications to consider. Even aside from people that had copays, even for our group of people that didn't have copays, there were access to care issues. So it's not like copays are the sole factor impeding access to care. It's one of many factors. And so underfunding is a huge issue. This results in understaffing, and so there aren't enough resources in prisons, and also leads to outsourcing for-profit private companies to provide healthcare, which means there's a financial benefit to not providing adequate care. And so I think that this is a strategy that should not be allowed, or at minimum, there should be some regulation about this. I think the other thing I wanted to bring up is there are some other policies that are helping with things like decarceration and ending mass incarceration, such as the First Step Act, which allowed a small number of people to have shortened sentences and early release. And there's a bill called the Safer Detention Act, which is advocating for increased use of compassionate release of elderly and the severely ill. Policies like these, decreasing the prison population, will help increase the per person amount of funding that there already is, though that still will not be adequate. There still needs to be an increase in funding overall. And one piece of policy that's been used to increase healthcare funding for people that are in prison is the Medicaid Reentry Act. And this is an act that is allowing people within their last 30 to 90 days of prison access Medicaid. As people listening to the show probably already know, people who are in prison don't have access to Medicaid or Medicare. They don't have, you know, publicly funded insurance that follows them into prison. Those policies end once they enter prison. And so this is certainly not enough to just have the last 30 to 90 days covered, but it is something. It's a start. And I believe there's already at least three states who have been approved to implement this process. And I think there's at least 11 other states that have applications to be approved as well. And a couple of important things that this would enable is, you know, if people are being covered by Medicaid, that means there's going to be an increase in oversight and a need for accreditation of healthcare systems within prison. Because in order to have public money go towards healthcare, it has to be monitored. And so that would be, I think, also a step forward for healthcare in prison.
I suppose the argument against it would be, well, it will cost too much. Yes, doing things right sometimes costs.
You're right when you say that people will argue that. But as we were talking about earlier, delaying needed care leads to more expensive care later on. And so, you know, while cost sharing may seem like an idea, what we see is that oftentimes it costs more later on because people don't get the needed care. And then they, instead of, you know, treating one acute illness, you're treating complications that are long lasting down the road.
How can people follow your work? Do you have a website or on social media?
Yeah, so I am on Twitter or X, and you can follow me at Emily_Lupez.
And do you have any closing thoughts for the listener?
Yeah, I guess I just want to, you know, put a call to action out there to advocate to your representatives as a matter of health equity to eliminate all co-pays for medical care in prison. My hope is that this work will educate people about the problem of medical co-pays and be a catalyst towards eliminating them.
That was my conversation with Dr. Emily Lupez, a general medicine and primary care research fellow at Cambridge Health Alliance and Harvard Medical School. She's lead author of an article entitled Health, Access to Care, and Financial Barriers to Care Among People Incarcerated in U.S. Prisons, which was published recently in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. Just so long.